Yeah, some people can be blamed, but I think what really made me sad is really made me, but like existentially sad. You know, I haven't had this in ages. Never, I think, never. Because, you know, when you have a war, you know more or less whom to blame. You know, you know what's going on. You can find what's going on, and it's not a big surprise. You know, but here, what really happened for me, to me, is that among highly educated people, among my very close friends, I have people who live in denial and believe in conspiracy theories, in very sophisticated conspiracy theories. And what was really terrible is to find out, I come from a family of scientific people. My father was an engineer, my mother was a pediatrician, and all my family, all the people I knew around me, even if they were not highly educated, have this kind of, you know, like pragmatic, scientific background. And I never heard that people could believe that you can clean the air with a prayer or with good energy, or I thought it was some kind of fun to do it. Why not? You know, I mean, placebo effects and blah, blah, blah. It's great, you know. But I never could believe that people so serious, so intelligent, so educated could really believe in bullshit.
Author, feminist, political activist, and filmmaker Yasmina Tasanovich joins John and Scoop in our virtual studio. Yasmina speaks to us from Italy, having just escaped from Serbia as the COVID crisis overwhelmed her native country. She gives us a very personal and moving account of the pandemic's impact on Eastern Europe and Italy.
Hey, welcome to the Plutopia podcast. For this edition of Plutopia, our guest is Yasmina Tasanovich. Yasmina is a feminist and political activist. She's originally from Serbia. She's also the author of 15 books. She's a journalist, a musician, a translator, and film director. More recently, she was one of the founders of Casa Yasmina, a smart home of the future in Turin, Italy. She is author of the manifesto and movement Internet of Women Things. She writes in three languages, and she lives variously in Turin, Belgrade, Austin, and Ibiza. Hi, Yasmina. And where were you?
Hi,
in,
hi,
are you,
hi.
You're in Ibiza now, right?
No. I never say where I really am. But okay, I'm going to say the truth today only to you. We're in Turin. I'm in Turin.
Okay. You're in
Turin. Yes. But we're heading to Ibiza, Corona permettendo, as we say here. Now it's all about, if you know, it's just a very nice Italian expression, Corona permettendo. Italian is my best language. I mean, everybody's best language, you know. So they don't say anymore here, Dio permettendo, if God allows, you know. We say here, Corona permettendo.
Maybe Corona is the new God.
Yeah, well, it's like, it's a, you know, I like about Corona as a god that it's so unpredictable. You know? So, I mean, like all the rules that you have with classic religions, the churches, as you know, everybody knows what you have to do, you know, especially the Catholic Church, with like the gray eminence of Italian culture. Everybody's Catholic in Italy, and even those who are against Catholicism, because it's some kind of an endemic thing, you know, you can't avoid it. I grew up here. And we have the Pope and everything, you know. But Corona is so unpredictable that maybe it will set people free, you know. I think those who believe in structures, because it's still not structured, you know. Nobody knows anything. And apart from conspiracy theories, which are really, really dangerous, and I think that they're going to split the world into those who believe in those and those who think they're very dangerous. But all the other scientific theories, which contradict each other, and we have very lively scene, like in Europe, about people speaking, I mean, scientists, not people, people too, but scientists of what's really going on, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, on how you behave, how you don't behave. And I'm like thinking, since we came just from Serbia like 10 days ago, and we were there in a lockdown, in a brutal lockdown, like a dictatorship, Chinese type, you know, it was like totally, nobody could get out. And it was like a martial law. You know.
But did you get stuck in Belgrade, or was it?
We got stuck. We got stuck.
Okay.
You know,
so you just happened to be there when the Corona thing happened.
Well, you know, we were like, you know, we were in Austin. We were supposed to come back, and I remember I said, "I'm not coming." You know, it's going to be canceled South by Southwest. And then we were in Norway. There were like 9 cases in Norway, you know. And from Norway, they canceled South by Southwest. And I was looking at the map saying, should we go to Torino? Which at that point, Italy was like, you know, focolaio. It was terrible, you know. People were dropping dead everywhere, you know. And then we had Ibiza. And I was like, if we go to Ibiza and get isolated on an island without health insurance, you know, which was wrong because they gave all the foreigners, you know, especially Americans, they had free healthcare. And then I said, well, Belgrade, Serbia, we have a flat, we have friends, we have health insurance, the best. So we got there. And the moment we got there, they locked us down. You know, I mean, like, that was, I expected severe measures, you know, but I didn't expect it to be so brutal. I mean, you know, people over 65 couldn't go out at all. You know what it means, at all.
So what did they do if they caught you out walking around?
Okay, so you had you had the police patrolling all the time. You know, they could fine you and they could expel you if you were a foreigner. I'm not a foreigner. Bruce is a foreigner, you know. But the only good thing about being expelled from Serbia meant that the other country, which had closed borders, to accept you, you know. So like there was a moment when I said maybe the best thing to get out of Serbia is to get expelled by Serbia by breaking some rules, you know. And this is a very classic method that works during the wars, you know, because I did a book on refugees during the wars. But you know, refugees are very often, they're invisible and nobody knows that they exist. They're without documents and this, that, you know they come from mixed marriages, from territories that are occupied. So you know, it's a mayhem. And in order to get some kind of recognition or paper, you have to make transgress, you know, you have to do something that they notice you. So this is also an option. It was very similar, you know, to the situation. That's my fourth lockdown, you know, in my life. And I'm not so old, but I'm old enough to have fourth lockdown in Serbia. You know,
what were the reasons for the other lockdowns?
Well, I got this question. I remembered only three, but the first time I counted them was, okay, the first one was during the bombings, you know, and we had this martial law and we had the sirens. And so it was a lockdown. We couldn't move. The second one was when our premier Gingic was killed. And we had one good guy who was after Milosevic was ousted, and he really ousted him properly, and then he was killed. He was like in power a couple of years, and when he was killed, his government shut us down. Like they tried to catch the killers, and it was kind of a good lockdown, you know. And then the third one, I was trying to remember which was the third one, and I don't remember it even, you know, 2 days ago. But there was in between, and then this is the last one. You know, the last one that.
But the other ones were political lockdowns, and this is a medical lockdown.
Yeah, but you know, it's the way they. I know, you know, the political and how would you know? I mean, in a way, even whatever lockdown is political, also, you know, the end, what decision you take, you know, how to lock down, whom to lock down. Like, look at Sweden, they didn't have any lockdowns, you know, and okay, this one was good because for the first time I saw in Serbia. The military being used properly, you know. I mean, like, they were not patrolling with guns, but they were, like, helping people. I must say there were very positive sides in this lockdown in Serbia. I mean, food was delivered at doors. It wasn't overcharged. We had all the masks, everything, you know. The hospitals were there, and it was well handled, you know, Chinese way. Except that then we had elections, and they let people loose, and now they're having another lockdown from tomorrow.
Okay? Can you go into detail more about the impact on the elections? What, you know, I haven't heard much about the election over there, but you know, it's having a big impact on our elections. But how was it over there?
The elections, or how the corona impact the election?
The impact of corona on the elections.
Well, you know, Vucic is somebody who changed his clothes and stole the philosophy of the opposition that ousted Milosevic. He's a right winger. He's basically, I don't know if it's proper to use the word fascist, but you know, he's there, you know. And what he did, he's like started speaking like democratic words, using democracy, but what he in reality is doing is a totalitarian, authoritarian regime, one man, God. And he's been elected now 4 years ago, and it was a very narrow way he was elected, like a little bit like Trump, you know. But in the meantime, he destroyed all the democratic institutions, no opposition, and our opposition is really lousy, really lousy. They fight each other, and you know they can't cope with what happened. So when the corona happened, he really used it very well. He's very skillful. Skillful politician. So he did bring in the Arabs, the Russians, the money. And if you look at Serbia, it is much better off than it was 4 years ago before he came in power. You know, it's like much better off from outside, you know. And when the corona menace happened, what he did was he organized pretty well the thing, lied a lot about the numbers, and brought in the Chinese like the first day. They came in, you know, in airplanes, and they organized us very well. They had field hospitals and the masks, everything. And so he came out as a hero. He addressed people every day, like speaking to the people, to Serbia. You know, he has this, I don't know, when you look at him, it's as if he's a lunatic or a very emotional man. And I don't think he's either of that. You know, it's like, but he has something that, I would say that it can appeal to very it can appeal to some very low key populist way, which most of the people in Serbia are like that. They like that, you know. And so he used it very well. And what happened was that they were telling us they're not, you know, the menace is going away. There's no corona, and then they opened totally, but totally, you know. And then I think they were lying about numbers, because now the numbers are coming out that actually. And then they ran this big football games, big gatherings. Novak Djokovic, the famous tennis player, certainly heard of him, the number one in the world, of course. He is the gray eminence of Serbia. I think he's more of a president than really Vucic. And he organized, he was always organized tennis games with a lot of people. And, you know, it was like after we won this big enemy, like nobody in the world, and we are such a small nation, of course, everybody voted for him. You know, we were predicting that at the elections, and I was like, I have a book called The Diary of a Political Idiot, written during Milosevic. And when I was like telling my friends what I think the election results would be, they said, you are still a political idiot. Instead, unfortunately, I said the truth. I mean, I won, you know. I only wish it wasn't like that, but yes, it was like that. So he really knew how to use it. And as we all knew, like the elections were on the 21st of June, we knew that things were going to get hairy immediately after the 21st, you know, and they did. And then all of a sudden, it's just hearsay. We heard from Pete that the hospitals are again full, that people are, you know, really sick. And at that point, the borders are still closed. And at that point, we just managed to get out on the first, like, plane flying all through Europe and hoping that we can manage to reach Italy, because we have residents in Italy. And we did. And that was like the last call, really, because then afterwards,
Serbia just declared a state of emergency.
Yeah. We escaped the emergency, but you know, it was like it was a difficult decision to make, because we had to we risked by doing this what we did. We risked by flying, not only getting sick, but also not staying in quarantine like in wherever, you know, like in Switzerland or in some airport. You know, we didn't know what we'll have, especially, you know, the combination of a Serb, Italian, and an American. I mean, we're like the picture of contamination, you know. This is like, you know, Americans are not allowed to come to Europe anymore, you know. So it's it already started, and when we were flying. So, but we risk in order not to get stuck another 3-4 month in Serbia, you know, because we don't really live there. So that's it. That's the long story.
It sounds like Serbia Serbia did the right thing at some point. Bringing in the Chinese, whereas Trump did the wrong thing of just alienating the Chinese and making them the bad guys. And it's unfortunate that didn't stick, because they did take a play out of Trump's playbook of opening everything up and pretending everything's okay.
Well, I'm looking at the charts for Italy, and it's impressive how well they've managed to decrease the number of daily new cases.
Yeah, hopefully, hopefully it's going to stay so because they opened too, you know, only like a week ago, and that's why I'm afraid that they will again start closing everything, and that we will not make it to Ibiza. So I'm keeping my eye open, you know, because they have the tourist season. They have no tourists, but you know, people are going to the beaches, and you know, Italians, as I mentioned before, they all do the same things at the same time, and this is the time of the year where they go to the seaside. They have a lot of sea, you know, all around. You know, Italian is like a peninsula, and it's not about only tourists from abroad. They are their own tourists, you know, so they have from Torino, in 1 hour you reach Liguria, Genoa, and beautiful beaches there, you know. So what they do is they disobey, you know. When they go to the beach, they forget. And I'm just hoping that that they won't. But you know that things won't happen again. But I think that as opposed to Serbia, where there were not so many dead people, notwithstanding the fact that they were lying. I know that in Italy it was terrible. So here people are more frightened. They saw something they didn't believe could happen to them, you know. And I can see it from just walking the streets, that people are wearing masks, that are washing hands, that you can't enter a shop without really keeping the distance. And, you know, people who are selling, restaurants are either closed or kept properly. And I can see much more discipline here. And I think it's not because Italians are better, but because they had they were frightened, and they have death toll, which like 1,000 people dying every day, you know, in a small country. So, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure, really. I'm frightened. 2 days ago, I had a panic attack, you know, like, or post-traumatic stress. I saw the numbers going up in Italy, and I saw the numbers going up in Spain since they opened, you know, now a week ago, both of them, both of the countries, I mean. And I said, okay, I'll never make it from Italy to Spain, which I have to, you know. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go on the first plane and do it. And then my daughter, who is in Spain, said, no, don't panic. You know, it's still fine. You know, besides, this is United Europe, and we are still in United Europe. And I guess we will be able to go from one country to another. But you never know. You know, who knows? Nobody knows, you know. So I'm still a little bit tense about that, you know. But and I'm not sure. I don't know how they're going to handle the schools, how they're going to in Italy, you know, or anybody, you know, but in Italy, it's not a very rich country, you know, and it's a very, let's say it has welfare, it has social welfare. And once you hit there, I don't know what will happen. It's not like US where you don't have it anyway, you know, I mean, so, you know, you had a little bit with Obamacare, but otherwise, you know, people are used to have, to be ready to pay your own, you know, bills. Medical bills, even though they're terrible here in Italy. Everybody's relying on the state for that. And it's been for ages like that, decades, you know. So I don't know what will happen there. And children go to free kindergartens, and the schools are free, and universities are free. And, you know, everything is... So I don't know if that's hit, what will happen. Already they're saying that one of the parents have to stay at home. And it means they will have only one pay, and people here work. You don't have housewives really in Italy, you know. You have both parents working, and people live on two pays, you know. So this is going to be an issue. But I don't know. I can't be a Cassandra in this case. I don't want to.
It sounds like the beaches you were talking about, it's a similar situation here. We have... the same problem in Florida, the beaches in Southern California, even in Texas, people flooding out to the beaches, you know, even though they know that there is no cure, there is no treatment that's working, but someone said it was okay, so everyone flocks out, and it's, you know, resulted in a huge spike of infections here in Texas. We're one of the hot spots now.
Yeah, I'm following that. All of my places are hotspot now. So it's like when you mention all the places I live, I don't think I left it. Oh, yeah, maybe some, but I'm not going. But you see, I don't think there's much difference, you know. I don't think there's much difference in anywhere. And you know, you can blame the people, but it's... Yeah, some people can be blamed, but I think what really made me sad is really made me, but like existentially sad. You know, I haven't had this in ages. Never, I think, never. Because, you know, when you have a war, you know more or less whom to blame. You know, you know what's going on. You can find what's going on. And it's not a big surprise, you know. But here, what really happened to me is that among highly educated people, among my very close friends, I have people who live in denial and believe in conspiracy theories, in very sophisticated conspiracy theories. And what was really terrible is to find out, I come from a family of scientific people. My father was an engineer, my mother was a pediatrician, and all my family, all the people I knew around me, even if they were not highly educated, have this kind of, you know, like pragmatic, scientific background. And I never heard that people could believe that you can clean the air with a prayer or with good energy, or I thought it was some kind of fun to do it. Why not? You know, I mean, placebo effect and blah, blah, blah. It's great, you know, but I never could believe that people so serious, so intelligent, so educated could really believe in bullshit, and bullshit which is so dangerous, not only for themselves, but for us. And, you know, at the end, what is going to be a war? Are we going to kill them? Are they going to kill us, or are we going to kill them? You know, how many people are refusing the vaccinations and the tests and the theory of contamination, how it goes. And this is like, for me, it was such a disappointment in the civilization that, you know, at this point, at this age, I'm not even sure, is it worth living? Not that I want to commit suicide, you know, but I'm just saying, is it worth being social at all, you know? Because I refuse to, like, while you're in Belgrade, and I have very dear friends, which I was so happy to see, and we would always go and party and talk and do stuff, you know, theater, music. And all of a sudden I realized I don't want to be with those people because I don't have the tolerance or the nerves to listen to this bullshit, you know, because it's dangerous. It's simply dangerous, and they're not listening to me. And this is like something that I think it's like, retreating, maybe it's a good thing to retreat now. You know, I have to think this out because I'm not going to look back, and I'm not going to be nostalgic about the times we had, because I just didn't realize what we were living in, what environment. Now that I see them coming out, it's I'm better off. You know, it's painful, but I'm better off. And, you know, apart from the personal disappointments, you can speak about societies and segments of societies which are like that, and everybody's showing for what they are. I will tell you an episode, like in maybe you did follow it in Italy, because it's very interesting how Italians came out as being Italians, you know, because Italians are Italians, you know. And I consider myself half Italian in the beginning of the epidemics here. And we were like in Ibiza, and we wrote this. We have a column, Bruce and I, for one of the major dailies in Italy, La Stampa. So we wrote about this. I said, why don't we write it from the point of view of coronavirus coming now to Italy? It wasn't even here. It was very marginal in Italy. And it was like January, something like that. And we wrote this, and La Stampa said, oh, we don't want to publish that. It's too pessimistic. And I said, come on, please do it. It is even funny. And they said, okay, but you have to take away the word morte, you know, because they're superstitious. They don't want the word death in it, you know. So I said, okay, I'll take the word morte, you know. And we published it, and it wasn't very popular. But in a month, we were quoted in the parliament, La Stampa, and us called Globalisti a Torino, Globalist in Torino, as the first people who wrote about it publicly and mentioning the worst case scenario, because here they're so like lighthearted and, you know, always crossing the fingers. If you mention the word death, even if you're in a cancer ward dying, you're smoking and drinking and not mentioning the word death. You know, there's some kind of superstition. And we mentioned in our text this zero patient in Italy. We were imagining him, you know. And we said, all of a sudden, Corona was speaking in the first person. Corona said, and I will make famous some people who are not famous at all, because they will be very famous as first patients of an unknown sickness and blah, 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 and so on, you know. And the zero patient in Italy is now, listen, he's like 80 years old, and he's some guy who's just a physical worker of the fields, a field worker, you know. He worked like, you know, he's like agricultural worker, and he was famous as a very, very good-natured guy who was always in the morning in his bar, in his little village near Bergamo, you know, where the thing exploded, where they had, were taking people in barrels, you know, yeah, instead of in the hospital. And so this guy, he would go to the bar and he would take his Prosecco in the morning, a little coffee with a little grappa and so on. But, you know, very nice guy, always laughing, always telling jokes, but nobody, you know. And I mean, not famous, you know. And then he got infected, and they said, okay, you have to go to the hospital. They put him in isolation, and he ran away because he always goes to dance every Saturday night. And you know, when they Italians go to dance, they don't go to dance, they don't dance like, you know, like free dancing, whatever, you can move your hands and your feet. No, they dance like tangos. They dance really well. Anyway, he infected the whole discotheque for all elderly people, which they have, wow, here, and then the whole village. And so the patient, and he died eventually, but the patient number one, and became really famous. Nobody knows where he got the infection, you know, the virus, but he became really famous. So this lack of discipline of going to see your mama, whatever, and killing her, but to not to see your mom, it's like in Italy, it's like, you know, kill me, but allow me to see my mom, you know, or let me go dance, or let me go this, and this is the Italian way of life, you know. And so in order to keep them contained and to make them understand not to mention the word death, not to mention, not to stop their habits, it was very hard. I think that was how they got these horrible numbers, and that's why after there were so many dead people and so many infected, you know, I know people who died. You know, I in my environment here, you know, I was speaking to my friend and we came back, like 50% of the people I know got sick, and seriously sick, you know, and they're not old and they're not sick. You know, they didn't have previous anything, you know, some, like I have a friend who is like 70 and her son who is like 40. The son is much worse off than she is, you know, and he's perfectly healthy guy, you know, but he is now he's like really badly off, you know. So I think, you know, the Italian way of life, the Italian culture was hugely, hugely strained and damaged by this corona. And their way of not handling was very Italian.
You see, do you think more so than Belgrade?
Sorry?
Do you think it was that there was more of a damage to the culture of Italy than
Belgrade, you know. Oh yeah, Serbia, yeah, definitely. Serbians, they love to have fun, but they can also, you know, they're very, very, how to say, obedient, you know. They're not conditioned in daily life by routines as much as Italians are. You know, Serbian people can eat, they don't eat 3 days if somebody tells them don't eat, you know, something like they have this fanatism, you know. This is part of Serbian culture, that they can do incredible stuff once they decide to do it, you know. And they're not so, you know, Serbians, the vanity of Serbian phrase is we are heavenly people. You know, like, because they don't live for the life on earth, they live for life somewhere else, you know, to be proper with the rules of heaven, you know. And instead, Italians, even though they have Pope, they live by the rules of, you know, everyday goderecho, as they say here, nice life, la vita è bella, you know. Dolce far niente, that kind of stuff, more pleasures, you know. So yes, definitely, definitely. It hurt much more the Italian, I would say, soul, you know, than the Serbian. The Serbians were hit because in economy, in comfort, but I think they took it much better than here. You could see that, really.
You talked about the bullshit that was being held on to by many people. We have government-sponsored bullshit here that seems to be causing the most damage. Is there a lot of that in evidence in Europe in general?
No, no. I know that U.S. is the producer of bullshit. You know, we know them. It's called Roberto Saviano. Have you heard of him? He's a writer. He wrote Gomorra, that made a film also. He's a very good Italian writer, young one. He got a fatwa from the mafia, and he lived in hiding for years on end. A young guy, you know, born in the 70s. And he has this, he's like also writes essays and, you know, for the papers. And so he has this this expression called shit machine, you know, how the governments produce. Like, you know, they're like mud. Shit is like mud, you know, and they throw it in the papers, on the people. And so U.S. is famous for bullshit machine, you know, and we know that, speaking of coronavirus, you know, and generally speaking also in other topics. But we didn't have governmental, I would say we didn't have it either in Serbia or especially not in Italy. You know, I think in Italy, there were many different voices, like saying this, that, or the other, not agreeing it. But I think the effort was there to try to figure out what's going on. And also, if you heard this vaccination that is being now trialed, and it's an Oxford thing, but it started by Italians, really. It's... if I'm not wrong, it's two young women from some research institute in Milano. And when they were speaking, when they isolated the virus, like before the pandemic, you know, they were kind of bullied and even like sacked, even though they were not like regular, they were just researchers, only to be taken back after a month, and they got like important prizes. And they went, they worked with the Oxford, some medical research place, you know, and they took the own vaccination on themselves, you know, as a probation. It seems it's working. Of course, it will take time to do it on bigger samples, you know, of people. But I'm very proud of the story, because there were two young women, you know, and of course as women, and also of young women, and who were saying something which is different from the mainstream science. So I would say that the problem in Italy would have been that the people who were established were like more authoritarian towards the new theories that the other people were saying. But I don't think we had it so much. There was something about Chinese out of lab, you know, that thing that they did broadcast it, some broadcast that was made like 5 years ago, but it was some kind of SF broadcast, you know, it wasn't even a real journalistic research, and they did broadcast it during the pandemic, and then everybody got so upset about it, like, you know, you're making people stupid in a situation when you have to reach a real real problem, you know. So I wouldn't say that we had it as much as you did, but we did follow what you had, and I was really glad I was not there.
Your story about the two women that were sacked, as you said, and brought back, as a feminist, did you see that as being caused by the machismo that is so prevalent in government?
I think it was, I think this government we have is a very nice government. It's mostly men government, but it's Conte is like a guy who was elected by chance. I mean, he was elected, it was a thing they couldn't get, he doesn't have a party, you know, behind him. And they couldn't get along between parties, they're fighting as usual. So they picked this guy who's like innocuous, you know, he's like a nice guy, a knowledgeable guy. And he never thought he would have to handle such a situation. And he handled it really well, because he doesn't belong to any party or any group, you know, so he knows how to deal with it. What I'm talking about, this women and what's happening is there is a phenomenon, and it's not about only the government. It's this phenomenon of major institutions that here it's called baroni, you know, it's a very traditional society. It's very Italian, you know, it's like in a way, like if you belong to this class of professors of university or else pharmacists, you know, like pharmacists are all held by the same families, because you inherit it, you know, you cannot easily, like I cannot come and open a pharmacy if I'm a foreigner, you know, even though I have money or whatever. No, you have to belong to this casta, you know, so they have this caste system. And universities, they're full of, and, you know, hospitals and like these governmental important institutions that are full of baroni, these barons, we call them here, you know. So I think these girls who are like women, and of course there are much less women than men, generally speaking, but they were also not part of casta. They just popped in like the Premier Conti, you know. I think they were perchance there, and perchance they said something that made sense, and that really hit badly, hit them the wrong way. But then, you know, it was also an opportunity for them to show what they really knew and open some doors, you know. So this would be my answer.
You're talking about going to Spain.
Yes.
How are they? And I haven't read about them lately. They were having a lot of problems, both politically and corona-related. How is the situation now in Spain?
Well, you know, Spain is made of different regions, as you may well know, and they're fighting each other, as you may well know, too, you know. And so we want to go to Ibiza. And a little introduction about Ibiza. Ibiza is an island, a rather big island, and it's a very old civilization there. It was like conquered by Arabs, by Catholics, by, who, you know, pirates. But it was always an island of people who were different, let's say. And during Franco's regime, it was an island where he was putting, it was like a, not a prison, but a political exile island, you know, and, you know, Franco lasted forever. So he was basically exiling there the political people who were not politically correct, I mean, dangerous, or gays and lesbians, and also people from their from Francoist regimes who were behaving badly, meaning druggies or, you know, whatever they were, you know, or like people of rich children who were like doing stuff that was not good for the public image of the regime. So you can imagine how Ibiza has this very different. And then in the 60s, the hippies came, you know, and then only recently it became like the sex, drugs and rock and roll island with big techno parties and rich people coming, but also very poor people coming, you know, because it's huge and you can survive. You can see like Paul McCartney coming incognito. And then also you can see people who come like on the boat, sleep on the beach. And, you know, they're not even begging. They're just, you know, how to say, chilling, you know, I don't even know what the word is, but it has this atmosphere. So it's quite different. It has its own government and it's Catalunya, but it's close to Valencia. And they have this splendid isolation ideology, history, you know. So my hope is to get there because they're isolated and get a direct flight. Otherwise, Spain is now having a lockdown in some parts of Catalonia again because of the big numbers, I think, they had again. But they're keeping it like very locally now because they need the season, the tourist season, you know. But Barcelona, the numbers are high. And the problem, the good side of Spain, now that I've been there and spending a lot of time, that they have something that Italians don't have, even though they have like similar needs in history, like they need tourism, they have the sea, they have the Latin people, they like to sing and dance and eat and blah, blah, blah. No, they have, the Spanish have something more, which is good. They have a high sense of civic duty. I don't know if you know what it means, civic duty. It's, I didn't know, but I got, they explained it to me, meaning they have this sense of honor. They never shortchange you. They never lie to you. They, if the rules are rules, they will like, they stop at the crossroads. They will always let the pedestrian walk, not because they're going to be fined, but because they have their own sense of civic duty and honor being citizens of something, you know. And this, you can really feel it on everyday level in Spain and in every town. It even bothers me sometimes, you know, like it's too much, it's too stiff. But this worked for Corona, because once the rules were established, they were really behaving, you know. And even though they had a lot of tourism, you know, because you don't know that Barcelona is has over tourism, so the Spain, you know, their season all year through. And even though they had this impact from all over the world, and before even the lockdown from outside, you know, they managed to handle it thanks to this kind of discipline they have, because they're different from the Italians, for example. That's my explanation. They're a little bit like Germans, you know, without being Germans.
just looking at charts, which I've been doing here, it looks like Catalonia may be doing a little bit worse than Spain as a whole.
Well, before it was not Catalonia, it was Madrid, which was the worst. But now it's Catalonia, because Catalonia has the seaside, you know, and the people are going yeah. now. They opened the borders on the 21st. They opened on 21st. They were city locked. They didn't have this general lock like we had in Serbia. There were only cities. You could move from one city to another, even from one municipality to another, you see. And they opened 21st of June for people to move through the municipalities, and on July 1st they opened to everybody. So now we're going to see what's going to happen, you know, when they have some kind, I'm not sure how it works, but I was reading about it, but nobody can give me the right info, like health, some kind of health passport, that once you land there, for Ibiza, sure, that once you land there, they give you some kind of tracking system, you know, those apps, but they're different from the ones that the Italians have. And you're supposed to, it's not a quarantine, you know, but you're supposed to, but I'm not sure how it works. So I'm not going to speak about it now in order not to say something wrong, you know, but I know they're working on that, and it's not an invasive way. It's not, I mean, it is a controlling system, come on, you know, but it's still a way of coping with it. And my daughter is there, and she's like, she works there. And she was yesterday, she was sending me the photos from the beaches and from our favorite, like, joints on the beaches, you know, not the fancy
ones. Yeah, I'm showing one now that you should be able to see from Costa Brava, and the beach is pretty empty right now.
But the people are following the rules. That's why I'm going to say, you know, like in Italy, the beaches are full and crowded, and you have the police patrolling them. Like, but in Ibiza, it's not like that. People are following the rules. They're sitting separate, you know, the tables are not together. Again, you know, I think if they behave that way, they will have less tourism, less places, but still they will have some. And instead, the mayor of Venice just yesterday said he's going to lock the city down because people are misbehaving, you know, and they have, again, the numbers are soaring, and he got so angry that he says he's going to force the sick people to the hospital, like with the police, they'll take him to the isolation, and he's going to lock down the city. And, you know, it might happen because of the, yeah.
Well, like there in Turin where you are now, are people wearing masks?
In the interiors?
There's this controversy about masks in the U.S. And I'm just wondering, in Europe in general.
Yes, yes, yes,
it seems
absolutely.
To me that they're probably wearing masks more readily.
Oh, yes. It's absolutely prohibited. You can't enter any public space, you know, from a small shop to a library without a mask. You even have to wear masks in the streets, which are crowded. The only places where you are not wearing a mask, where you're allowed not to wear a mask, like alone in the park or in the streets where there is nobody. Sometimes you are in the part of the city where there is nobody, you know, because this is a very urban, Torino is very urban, you know, it's not like Austin, you know, where you have only downtown and then you have just houses outside, you know, nobody walks. No, here everybody, and you have to wear it in the trams, but the trams have the seats. So it's obligatory, and there is no polemics about it. It's obligatory, and the fines are huge.
Here's a question. I know that people are very fashionable in Turin. You guys have told me that before. And I'm wondering if people are wearing fancy masks, like high fashion
masks.
Yes,
yes, yes. Now, you see, we came from Belgrade where the masks, we had them free and they were everywhere. And, you know, it's like they will give you, like, when you enter the shop in Belgrade, they give you gloves and masks, you know, so it's not like you had to pay for it. But in Italy, the moment we came here, gosh, my God in heaven, even Prada makes their own masks, you know? And we were in this museum, and it was the day before yesterday when we went to a museum where they also have this way of controlling us. You can enter only, you know, but it's a huge castle and it's a huge museum. And there was this show, but you know, there was artsy people there. And I was just admiring the mask more than the paintings, you know, because they were amazing masks. You know, people were, yes. And I was just thinking, I'm like a hick walking around with a medical mask in Torino. I must really get myself some fancy masks. And I was like wondering if they're really protective or just, you know, decorative. And I stopped a woman with this fabulous mask. And I asked her, she said, well, I put an under mask and a mask on top, you know, but that means that with this heat that we have here, wearing two masks, it's a little bit too much for me, you know. You know, to put a medical underneath and then a fancy one on top. And I was just saying to Bruce, come on, let's do something. Let's work on masks. But yes, everywhere, even on the flea market, you have people selling masks. It's fantastic. Do you?
It sounds great. Well, it's starting to be a thing here. I've noticed a lot of diversity in masks. Initially, people were wearing like very typical bandanas, or they were wearing like white masks, or they were wearing like the kind of mask a carpenter might wear, or that sort of thing. But now you're starting to see really fancy masks appear, or really colorful masks.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I mean, in Texas, you would wear la bandana, you know, I mean, it's like, I like the fact that it's very regional and cultural. What we notice also, and first I thought I was like having some kind of hallucinations because I was in a lockdown for so long and haven't seen a shop, you know. Well, yeah, you know, it's like that, you know, you don't even want to go out after. But you see, you live in a house, you have a garden, you live, I know your house, you know, we've been there so many times, but we live in small flats, you know, in Europe. It's not like the most we have is a little terrace, you know, so going from one room to another is already like a trip, and we got used to it. It's amazing how people get used to it, you know.
And you can't get out and walk, right? You've got
no, we couldn't get out here. No, we couldn't walk, we couldn't go down, you know, I mean, like we had to stay at home, you know, and that's it, you know, just stay at your own home. And this goes on weeks on end, you know. So first when we started, when we're allowed to go and walk and shop, you know, and see in Italy also. And I was saying, how ugly shoes all of a sudden became in Italy, you know. And I thought maybe because I'm not getting it. But then Bruce said, yes, they look Romanian, they look German, they're not cheap, they're ugly. You know, there's something like the fashion change, and they change probably because now people are focusing what is selling. If something is selling at all, but what is selling, people will need shoes anyway, but they don't need fancy shoes anymore because you don't go to parties, you don't go to, you know, to theater, you go to opera where you would put high heels or, you know, the fancy shoes, or you don't go to the banks anymore. You do everything online. All those habits that where you would doll up, dress up and be, that now what you need is a comfortable pair of shoes, you know, where you have to queue for hours. Like, you know, I have to queue for the post office to send a document. I just phoned and they said we have only 30 people outside, meaning only 2 hours of queue. And since I broke my knee, I said, you know, 2 hours is a little bit lot. I'll come tomorrow at 7 a.m. and then maybe it will be only 20 people, you know. So this is like, now you have to queue, you have to walk long distances because nobody's using trams and metros because of avoiding corona. And you have to ride a bicycle or, you know, one of those gadgets that now they're inventing. And you can't do it in fancy shoes, can you? Or you can't do it in fancy clothes. You have to. So the fashion has changed. It's very interesting how it has changed. Much uglier, much less Italian.
It sounds like they've chosen function over fashion.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like there's people in the USA who have been in their pajamas for like 3 months.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm one of those.
Not speaking of myself, of course.
I remember that thing from other lockdowns that I had, you know, and I remember that one of the points of not losing it in this thing that goes on forever and you don't know when it's going to end is like to wake up every morning as if you had to go to work, to wash, to put makeup on, to dress. You know, it's one of the ways, especially if you have children, because in the other lockdowns I had children, small children. And if you don't do that kind of, you know, to eat properly at the proper time of the days. So when now Bruce and I were alone, we didn't have children, but at least we had each other, which is much better than people were alone. But what we did was like we tried to do that, you know, like more rituals than ever. We had a date. We would meet in the living room every day at 6 and watch a movie, you know, and discuss a movie. And I think that is, and, you know, dress, not be in pajamas, you know, and cut our hairs and, you know, like really even more so because this is very important. It's like in a prison, you know, the people who get out of those habits, they get really depressed, you know. And people who, and I knew it from other lockdowns that you have to fake it. You know, I remember like during the lockdown we had during the sanctions. Oh yeah, one was bombing and the other was sanctions. Sorry. We were like during the sanctions, we were in the mountains and I was there with 3 small kids and there was nothing to buy food. I mean, we had like peasants coming up to our house. We had a mountain house there and the shops were closed and empty because of the sanctions. But the peasants would come and they would just sell us what they had, like, meaning milk, eggs, and a little bit of cream and nothing else, you know. So the kids were bored eating every day milk, you know how kids are. But then I found some chemical engineer, you know, and his specialization, he had a PhD in Manchester in this it's very famous, still exists. And they did colors, you know, I mean, specializations in coloring everything, food and, you know, like smart colors. And that was his passion until the very end. And in the basement, even though he's dead 10 years now, in the basement, he had these colors, food coloring, you know, and incredible colors. And I mean, it was not dangerous to use them. And they could stay there. They were like so well packed that they would last like for 100 years. You know, he was also specialized in that. So I found those tins of colors and I was coloring the food for the kids, which was always the same, you know, and saying, no, this is couscous. And this is like, I was giving them names, you know, and of course the kids never knew what couscous is because never tried before. So this kind of fantasy role playing and dressing and, you know, coloring the food. We did the same thing now, you know, and I think I remember, like, we were cooking like crazy. I know everybody was cooking, but we were like also experimenting. We were fighting who will cook better, you know, and the same thing like dressing also.
That's amazing that the artistic part of you came out and even influenced the food.
Yeah, I believe that every human being has a very strong artistic flair, and that especially kids have that. I think they all have perfect pitch and they all know how to draw. But then, you know, life takes you in another direction. Even math is something that is in a way innate to kids, you know. But then you take just one direction, you can't have it all, which is quite normal. Or you have hard life or whatever, you know. There are sad stories, there are less sad stories, but something happens. And then when you have this free space or boredom, everybody was doing something artistic. And I noticed that most of the time they were writing books. I didn't write anything because I was so, you know, I keep repeating it. It was so interesting to follow what was going on in the world with this pandemic. I mean, it's in a way we are like fortunate that we live through a pandemic. We only read about it, researched about it. Imagine like Bruce, who wrote about pandemics all his life and now he's living it. And besides, listen to this. This is this coincidence. We were in the flat of my late ex-husband, who was a poet, and he wrote this very famous book. He's a very famous poet. He has a square and this flat called The Quarantine, you know. And it was, we were in his house. He left to us, you know, my daughter and us, you know, he died, you know. And the part of town, Zemun, where we were, it's on Danube, exactly on Danube. It was a quarantine for years on end between the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Turkish Empire, meaning you had to, in order to cross the Danube, you crossed from one empire to another, huge empires, you know. It is also a place where Suleiman the Great died in this quarantine, you know. And so the whole town is called the quarantine. It has a huge hospital, and now it's schools or whatever. So basically, we were like living something like living novels, history, you know, living through centuries, you know. And I was like, I didn't want to write. I wanted to read, you know. I wanted to read every morning what other people are writing in other parts of the world, what scientists, and, you know, in a way, I consider it a painful but a great opportunity, you know. And besides, it wasn't so painful because we didn't get sick. That's really, there was fear in the air that we might, as I say, we had a couple of times. Whenever you would sneeze, we would look at each other and say, is that it? Okay, you know, so a couple of times we did have corona, but it wasn't really corona, you know, still, it still isn't. Who knows, sooner or later we may get it, but, you know, for the time being, we're holding, you know, we're hanging in there like you, like everybody else, you know, and it just, it's now, it's a human condition, it's part of us, you can't look back, you better not. Don't be.
And nobody really knows where this is going, do they?
No. We can't get nostalgic, and we shouldn't be weak about it. We should just face the music and think about, you know, I will have my first grandchild is coming in 2 months, you know, and our first grandchild, yeah. And she'll be born Frida. She has a name. And Frida will be born into this world as a corona baby, you know. I mean, she's going to live with it. She's going to be born it, you know. My daughter went a couple of times for scans and everything, and people around her had corona, and, you know, it was very stressful, but that's exactly who she's going to be. And I was remembering how when my daughter was born, we had AIDS coming in, and the generation of my daughter had completely different sexual life and freedom and love life than we did, you know, because of AIDS. And I can compare it to, I'm comparing it, I mean, to this, what's happening, what Frida is going to live through, you know. It's going to be different. And we just have to help them. What else, you know? And they'll help us, I hope, without killing us.
We're at a point where we kind of need to wrap up, but do you have any final words?
No, I never have final words. It's too, you know, I can't outsmart myself. Oh, I hate those. I hate the endings. I write letters without endings, and I don't even have a beginnings. I always say, like, I will speak second. You know, it's really tiresome to have the openings and the closing. So let's just cut it as it is, okay?
You do realize those were your final words.
And I hate saying, I say thank you, and I never say I'm sorry.
You may follow Yasmina's work on her blog, yasminatasanovich.wordpress.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.